This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Joshua Zeidner. We're going to be discussing Israeli internal politics. Joshua, great having you back on the show.
Oh, hey, Robert. It's always a pleasure to be here.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Matthew Pegas.
Great to be here, Robert. Nice to meet you over the internet, Joshua.
Yeah, likewise.
So this subject matter is going to focus more on Israeli internal politics, and we'll also connect this with issues relating to the United States. So, I remember the first show we did, Joshua, you were talking about how Israel is a model for social nationalism. Would you say that's your basic premise, or would you say that there's this element, especially among Likud, that is basically pushing the country in a more kind of neoliberal direction?
Well, so let me just sort out a few things. First off, it's important to understand that Israel came from the same sort of political traditions and, ideological pedigrees that, the National Socialists of Germany did, which is something that a lot of people really don't understand so clearly, and I think part of that is because intentionally, that kind of viewpoint is somewhat suppressed for reasons I think virtually anyone could determine. So not only were they, both of the same sort of brand, but they even collaborated with each other, and this is a fact. And in fact, in the last few years, a lot of this information is starting to come to the surface about, various characters who were somewhat prominent in Israeli politics at the beginning, or rather Zionist politics, who in fact not only collaborated with the Nazis, they were also involved in the Holocaust, believe it or not. I mean, it's somewhat controversial. We don't have to go into that information in this show, but there's a great book called Perfidy by Ben Hecht, and he goes into what's called the Rudolf Kastner affair, which I recommend to virtually anyone who's interested in the subject. Okay, here's one point of Israeli history that a lot of people don't understand. When the Holocaust was over, and they had the issue of managing those the survivors of the Holocaust, okay, the ones that came to Israel were not necessarily greeted with open arms. Right? Again, this is going to disturb a lot of people, but they even, in some cases, the Israelis referred to them as soap. They use the Hebrew word for soap. This is not a joke. Okay, this is well documented. It's actually in Haaretz. So The history that we often get is that Israel was a haven for the Jews of Germany. That is not true. That really needs a great deal of correction. The Jews that were in Germany were the ones opposed to Zionism. The reason they stayed in Germany was because they believed in the concepts of diaspora Jewry. They believed you could be Jewish and German at the same time. That's the reason why they didn't leave, around the end of World War I, when it became possible to live in Palestine. That's the reason why they didn't leave, because they opposed the ideology of the Zionists. All right. Now, after the Holocaust happened, the survivors went to a variety of places. U.S. was one major destination. South America and Israel was another one. Typically, that was the last choice of the survivors of the Jewish survivors of Nazi Germany. They had much, much different ideas about what Jewishness meant, and they had much, much different ideas about politics in general. You would call these people liberals today. They believed, they didn't really believe in a strong concept of patriotism and nationalism. They believed in this sort of, what you would call basically a liberal, somebody who believes the country's there to provide for their material needs, you know, a couple other key sort of qualities, you know, that you associate with liberals. That's who those people were. Okay, they did not agree with the Zionists. And unfortunately, what happened in Israel was that they started to, like, commercialize the Holocaust. They called it the Holocaust industry. There's a guy named Norman Finkelstein who wrote quite a bit about this. And they utilize it. Now, the idea of Israel saying that their existence was a sort of solution to the Holocaust, that's very, very intellectually dishonest. That's a very, very severe distortion of history, and it's just absolutely not true. You know, for the reasons that I just cited, and also, in some cases, some of the early Zionists were, in fact, collaborating with Nazi Germany. So let's clarify that first, and then maybe we can arrive at some more useful questions about, you know, who Likud was. I'll say a couple of things about Likud at this juncture. Likud was the ideological sort of descendants of the Irgun and those related parties. And those people were the ones that were negotiating with Hitler. You know, were they collaborating? Did they agree with everything that he said? Not really. But certainly they were on talking terms. That's a proven fact. You know, there was something called the Havara Agreement, and basically Nazi Germany wanted to send Jews to Palestine. And the Nazis, the Zionists, wanted to sort of coordinate this agreement. So Zionism was not at the beginning in opposition to the Nazis. That perception emerged much later.
So with the history of Israel's economic policies, the kind of origins were basically on social nationalism, and more recently it's gone in a more neoliberal capitalist direction. Would you say, there an influence explicitly from National Socialist economics?
Well, it was just the assumption of how, National Socialism, it emerges, it's informed by a set of key assumptions, about how a state should be run and what are the values that a state should embody, right? And those ideas were very much part of the early Zionist enterprise. The neoliberalism, like this idea of, let's call it a house for a free market, okay, a home for a free market. These ideas, I think virtually all your listeners will be at least somewhat acquainted with. You know, what I call neoliberalism, that's the formal term for it, but a lot of other people call it libertarianism. So, you know, those kind of concepts started to come into play in Israel during the mid to late 80s, roughly, and that was kind of, they were incorporated into the Israeli idea around the time that the USSR was starting to collapse. Because I think Israel, this is really a theoretical, you know, I think Israel was sort of trying to find, like, you know, whose side are we on, and how do we align ourselves ideologically with a partner that makes sense. Obviously, that partner was the U.S. You know, Israel wasn't always joined at the hip to the U.S. either. You know, that kind of happened, that solidified during that period. There was also a character named Meir Kahan, and that's M-E-I-R, not M-A-Y-O-R, just for your listeners to, in case they, you know, make a spelling mistake and they want to check up on this. There was a character named Meir Kahan, and he sort of pioneered a lot of these sort of right-wing Zionist Judaism. And those kind of ideas are what virtually any American, I would assume Matthew here too, associates with Israel, which is like this idea of like taking the Jewish religion, you know, taking like almost a comical reading of it, combining that with like evangelical Christianity and American jingoism, and that's Israel. Israel was not always like that.
What I know about Kahan is primarily his harsh stance on the Arabs, but does this also tie in with the whole economic angle? Because I'm not that familiar with his economic views.
Well, they seem to kind of like go together, you know? It's like peanut butter and jelly. You know, when you have these right-wing religious people, then, you know, invariably they seem to promote, these kind of like right-wing libertarian ideas. For reasons that remain somewhat mysterious, at least to me, I'm sure there are experts that understand, you know, exactly how these various values networks work together. But, you know, all I'll say for here is that you know, they tend to play well together, you know? So.
Well, as far as the issue of Israel goes, you consider yourself pro-Israel, but do you think the whole pro-Israel narrative and pro-Israel movement within the United States and the West in general is within the framework of, say, the Likud party and the neoconservatives?
I think my view of it is, and I've spent so much time with this particular topic in my life that, you know, my ideas and understanding have certainly changed over time. You know, I think that the whole Bibi Netanyahu thing, it's very, you know that the average Israeli believes he's a very corrupt person. That shocks Americans when they hear this. You know, they think Bibi is just this well-loved person. He's not. He's considered, almost everyone there thinks he's a crook of some sort. So I think that the whole thing is, you know, it's part of what the American military, their agenda and the power that they're trying to exert in the region, to what ends, again, you know, we can only guess at. I'm sure it has something to do with oil, something like this. You know, and the agenda is not for Israelis. And when you said before, I see myself as pro-Israeli, I actually changed that. I'm sorry, I see myself as pro-Israel. I changed that to I see myself as pro-Israeli. You know, I want to make it very clear that I view the government that's in power there to be corrupt regime, and it needs to leave. Not really for the sake of Arabs alone, although I do think their welfare is important. I think it's important for the welfare of Israelis first and foremost, because this government is driving them into a form of warfare that will never, ever end. How could you live in a country where the leadership has declared perpetual, never-ending war on billions of all of your neighbors? How exactly do you consider that to be a safe place for anyone, Jew or what have you? So that's my view of what's going on there. You know, so how does that change, and how do we improve the situation there? It's really simple, and there's been a lot of voices that have been saying this for a very long time that just ignored, you know, the social media sort of filters those people out and no one ever hears from them. But you need to install a civil rights system. I think it's very, very simple. Much like they have in Europe or America, people have rights that are independent of their religious views, of their race, you know, a couple of other key things. And from there, you know, we make sure we have a credible justice system, which Israel also doesn't have. And once you have justice installed, you know, you can start to mitigate, you know, some of these long-term chronic security problems that they have there. Israel's the only country on earth that has issues like this that are never resolved. Why are they never resolved? They want perpetual war there. I think for a number of reasons. They profit off of it. You know, they don't want a stable democracy. For instance, you know, their stable democracies did emerge in oil-bearing countries twice. Okay, can you guys guess what two countries that was?
Iran, one of them, under Mossadegh?
That's right. That's exactly it. So, you know, what happened soon after Mossadegh came in there and tried to establish, you know, a civil democracy, not unlike the U.S., you know, they deal with him. He's dealt with, he's gone. And then the Shah, and then the revolution, and then basically modern Iran. And the other one is obviously, I'm sure you guys know, Venezuela. You know, look what happened there. These things aren't coincidental. You know, and as a lot of people have pointed out, you know, there's a really great book out there. I'm sure you've heard of it before, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. You know, and he outlines generally what our country's actually doing. And, you know, I believe he mentions Iran in there, although I'm not completely sure. I know he goes into a lot of detail about Ecuador. And that's kind of what we do. You know, we go in there, we thrash these societies of these places that we want the resources from. You know, the citizens are kept blind with this religious doctrine and all this nonsense and hoopla to keep them constantly distracted.
So with Likud, there's this issue of suppressing political dissidents and their political opponents. Are they suppressing the right-wing Zionist types or the more left-wing socialist types, or both?
Well, they are the right-wing Zionist types. So the other right wing, which is you would call the religious right wing, they are generally anti-Zionist. Again, it's another factor to the whole thing that a lot of Americans don't realize, that, you know, they think the people running Israel are these funny guys with black hats and, you know, side curls. Those people generally are against the Israeli government. Okay, so it's important to understand that. So recently, you know, to stay current and, you know, make this thing somewhat of a contemporary discussion, you know, you have this thing that recently happened called the nationality law. Some people are calling it the nation-state law. And what it did, you know, legally it wasn't really that controversial, but what it did was it sort of confirmed a lot of the political ideas that sort of floated around for many, many years, and those are these really right-wing, modern Orthodox Zionist settler people, you know, who believe, among other things, that Arabs are not really citizens of Israel. Before that, as you mentioned, you know, there was some controversy about how lenient the Israeli government should be towards protesters. And there was a really interesting case that probably your listeners would find fascinating, that this is actually going on. There was somebody named Ariel Gold. All right, Ariel Gold is like a Jewish lady from upstate New York. I think she lives in Ithaca. I think she's a professor at Cornell, if I'm not mistaken. And she's been a pretty prolific activist in, you know, BDS politics. That's like, you know, divestment of Israel. You know, so they use that language because, you know, to her, she's not really against Israel. She's just simply against what's going on in Israel, right? Now, she wanted to involve herself in some kind of a program, some sort of an event that was happening in Israel. She flew into Israel and they actually turned her away at the airport, you know, which was... I'm not sure if that was the first precedent of that, but it was certainly the most notable one. And why does the Israeli government do that? You know, they're very concerned about instability, and they should be. Now, is it right for a government to suppress the activities of citizens, or in the case of Israel, potential citizens? And that's a very important, unique characteristic about Israel. It's not the government has to consider not only the people who are citizens, but also the people who could potentially become citizens, which is exactly what Ariel Gold decided to do. She said, well, if they're not going to let me in there, I'm going to declare Aliyah. And Aliyah is the Hebrew term for, it means going up in Hebrew. And it's the name for when a non-Israeli becomes an Israeli and declares their citizenship to Israel.
Is that what you did, or you just lived there temporarily?
I've never done it. No, I've never declared citizenship. I thought about it and considered it a couple of times, and just recently I decided there's no way I'm doing this, and I don't agree. You know, I kind of came out on Facebook and said, I don't agree with what Israel's doing. This is totally atrocious, you know, and I do not agree with this direction, and I really don't. You know, I think that if Israel abandons their civil rights basis, what are they? Some religious state? Are they any better than these radical Muslims we're claiming to be fighting? No. Absolutely not. Just because, you know, they believe in some doctrine aside from Islam. To me, you know, they work the same way. So, duck's a duck, right? And, you know, what they're doing is just, it's really what happened was, and you saw this all throughout Facebook and social media, was suddenly you're seeing like the Jenga tower fall. I used that metaphor when I was writing on my profile. That, you know, the Israelis didn't really realize when they take out this little thing that maybe they thought was inconsequential was actually huge. It's having the effect of making Israel something that's unsupportable to Americans.
It's because incredibly sets a dangerous precedent to have a one-party state. Obviously,
absolutely, I mean, it does.
Yeah, and that's the problem with any country. I mean, California is basically a one-party state, and it's become extremely corrupt, and two-party systems with Republicans and Democrats, I mean, that's bad enough as it is. Ideally, we should have, like, multiple parties, but yeah, one-state system is, that's a very dangerous precedent.
Right, and what Bibi does is anytime his position is threatened, you know, it seems like Arab terror just flames up. A lot of people speculate that, you know, that this is actually being orchestrated. As in, you know, the moment people look away from Bibi, then boom, boom, you know, rockets start falling. You know, it seems a little bit far too coincidental for my taste. And, you know, there's also other background information that, too, like Ariel Sharon was involved in the creation of Hamas. You know, does this say, matter-of-factly, that Israel is running Hamas, or the same these Likud people are running Hamas? I don't think we're quite there yet with this case, but, you know, I think it deserves some treatment. You know, who is actually doing this? You know, where's the money going? Because in Israel, they don't have any laws like this about, like, KYC and, you know, anti-money laundering. KYC means know your customer. So in Israel, you know, money can just move around freely without anybody obstructing it.
Is it a major center for organized crime?
I think so. That's the way I view it. Other people will say it's the IDF or virtually any Israeli I've ever gotten to know on a personal level who's willing to be straight up with me will tell you that Israel is an extremely corrupt country. It bleeds out even from military or exploitation, profiteering, that kind of stuff. Even like the civil structure is incredibly screwed up. Like the family courts in Israel are horrendous. You know, I've heard dozens of stories about people who have to deal with their children in Israel. You know, they have to the courts tend to take, there seems to be this tendency for the courts to alienate the children from their parents. So
with all this corruption, I think Robert has this in the outline to ask him about. What are the dissident politics like in Israel? Is there a social nationalist kind of movement that would be opposed to the leading party? Are there left-wing dissidents? What is that like?
Yeah, there's something like a Green Party. I guess you would say Merkez is probably that one. Israeli politics, the mechanics of Israeli politics is really quite different from American politics. And Americans can probably learn a little bit from how Israelis do their voting. You know, like, the way that it works in Israel, there are many, many parties. And in America, it's like, you know, they tend to completely monopolize all of your attention on the candidates that they're running. And then you always have this, well, you're going to throw your vote away if you vote for this guy. And then, you know, we're kind of left with either Coke or Pepsi. And, you know, that's just kind of like how American politics works. In Israel, what typically happens is people are very loyal to their one little party.
So kind of what we were talking about earlier is there was this history with social nationalism and right now the whole basic economic trend is towards neoliberalism, and that has to do with factors within Israel, but would you say is that major influence of these billionaires from the United States like Sheldon Adelson or Chaim Saban?
And also, there's also the owner of Times of Israel. You know, he's a billionaire, I believe, and also very much opposed to Trump. And he owns what is now the most dominant American Israeli political website. And this website is all completely integrated into social media. So I'm sure they have extensive metrics about, you know, what issues various people are interested in and how to kind of engineer the democratic process. You know, so there's that guy too. But I want to make a distinction. You know, you have like libertarian sort of economics policies that are affecting Israelis, then you have international capital, which also affects the situation in Israel. So, you know, the attitudes inside of Israel towards that kind of thing, you know, I mean, I'm sure you guys are aware that, you know, the history of Israel, most of them were living on these cooperative communes. I think probably, I would say up until about 1960 or 70, they seem to have completely petered out by the end of the 80s. And the libertarianism ideas, like especially the high-tech sector, that started around the mid-80s. There's a couple of fairly notable internet companies that emerged from Israel during that time, especially. Do you remember ICQ?
Sounds familiar.
ICQ was like the first, it was before AOL Instant Messenger. It was really the first instant messaging service. You know, these guys figured out a way to do this, and it was very novel at the time. And, you know, that was developed in Israel. And there's been a number of internet companies that sprung up there. Although I will say this, that I think a lot of this activity is really meant to kind of sell Israel as a country to especially America, you know, the West, quote unquote. You know, people who believe in this notions of free market capitalism. I think that the vast majority of money being made in Israel is not in this sort of casual IT sector. You know, you talk to anybody who really works in it, and they'll tell you it's actually grueling. It's very inefficient. There's nothing really particularly appealing about it, but it seems to exist anyway, because I think the Israeli government wants people to believe that Israel is something like Silicon Valley. The bulk of the money being made there is definitely on arms, and also things like surveillance. I think that that's a big, big part of what Israel does. You know, people often wonder, like, well, who the heck is building all this stuff? You know, like, all of these software systems that are spying on people. A lot of that stuff does happen in Israel. It's a fact. You know, they're not open about it. They develop it there, and, you know, it's exported here. For instance, there was one of the hardware units that Cisco is using to spy at on a protocol level. So in other words, you know, like, they want to be able to manipulate internet traffic based on web. So, like, if you hit a certain website with a certain keyword in it, you know, or maybe do something on the web, they want to throttle the traffic, slow it down, they want to block it, or maybe they want to reroute it to somewhere. And keep in mind, you know, for some of these applications, you're talking about millions of simultaneous users. I mean, these applications are gigantic. So the hardware, most famously, was developed in Israel to do this sort of stuff. And I'm sure there's plenty of things we don't see. So that's really what's going on in Israel as far as high tech goes. And, you know, these so-called, I think, like, the free market and all these notions that you hear as selling points for Silicon Valley and stuff, it works exactly the same way there that it does here. It's really part of their political agenda. You know, like, for instance, Silicon Valley is constantly, you know, tooting their horn about the wonders of the free market and how it's going to create jobs, but meanwhile they employ non-Americans. I mean, how exactly is that benefiting Americans, these policies? They're really not, when you really tally it up. You know, so that's kind of the situation. I don't think it's 100% sincere.
Joshua, you worked for a tech company in Israel. Are you able to elaborate on what your particular career was?
Well, I can't really get into the details much about what these people did out of just general professional respect. It wasn't really anything, like, you know, sinister, at least on the surface, anything I was doing. You know, there's a lot of these kind of companies in Israel, you know, that deal with social media metrics and social media manipulation, especially around the fields of e-commerce and politics. There's a lot of these companies there. And, you know, I just sort of found these people on the net or something, and the whole thing, I think, lasted a couple weeks, and it was difficult, to say the least, you know, even from the start. And one anecdote that I thought was really interesting about this place, the CEO was just this joke woman. I mean, I'm guessing she had some kind of connections to the IDF or something, which is why she was there, because she knew absolutely nothing about how to do software. But she gives me this book, you know, it was called, like, Startup Nation. Have you guys ever seen that one?
I've heard of it, but I haven't read it.
Okay, it's a book about that sort of tries to celebrate Israel as this wonderful engine of innovation, right? Basically, Israel is great because, you know, it started this wonderful innovation scene, and it's saving the world. You know, anyone who goes on Facebook constantly gets bombarded with these posts about it, how Israel is saving, is curing cancer or what have you. So, you know, she gives me this book, Startup Nation. That's what the thing was about. And I'm like, all right, I'll read this. You know, at that point, I had zero trust in this woman anyway. But so it starts listing these things. And this book was already like 15 years old. And it's talking about how Israel invented cars that don't use gasoline. And it was already 15 years, you know, there's, I mean, in case you guys don't know, there are no cars in Israel that, that do not use gasoline. So it shows you, to me, I thought it was rather hilarious that this book is extolling this technology that Israel had that doesn't even exist. And It was talking about it 15 years ago. You know, so there's certainly a measure of fraud, you know, and deception that's going on there about what exactly is being developed in Israel.
So you,
they don't have, but you would say the situation is perhaps similar in the U.S. and a lot of countries with a neoliberal bent.
As in, well, I think that in virtually anyone, you know, this goes back to even the World's Fair. You know, you guys know what the World's Fair is, right?
Oh, yes.
The Chicago.
Yeah, I mean, there was a very good reason why they made the World's Fair. It wasn't just some spontaneous thing. You know, like, very rich people wanted to instill the populace with this idea of a love of technology and progress.
Yeah,
right?
Progress.
And certainly, yeah, exactly. You know, and it, in a lot of ways, it's a really old story. And Silicon Valley is the same thing. You know, they want to wow people. They always try to target, especially young white males, seems to be their favorite targets for this kind of propaganda. And once they've sort of set their minds in a certain direction, like, you know, technology is good, it's going to improve your life, you're going to be rich if you participate in this stuff, you know, it's in a lot of ways a very old story, but we never really seem to quite get that, right? I mean, they invented the internet, we were all supposed to be informed, life was going to be what do they call it, like everything was going to be very efficient and frictionless, right? You know, like they had,
well,
all
we're
these,
all doing this show and we've all met each other because of the internet, so we can't,
yeah,
really,
I was gonna say,
completely.
We do have the stark truth.
Yes,
true.
Yes.
But I get what you're saying. Sure.
But those basic technologies were not invented by the free market, they were invented by DARPA. You know, so
that's true, yeah.
We cannot accredit the free market with these things. We can accredit, in fact, National Socialism. If there's one aspect to American our structure that was National Socialism in character, would be NASA. In fact, there were a lot of ex-Nazis who worked for NASA. Fact. Okay, so we can't really attribute that to the free market. You know, I'm a big critic of these ideas, personally. I have been for a very long time. You know, they tell us that the free market's going to give us all these wonderful things, but really, the only thing that seems to happen with the free market is they invent better ways to make themselves rich.
You basically worked in Israel, and then you worked in the tech industry in the Silicon Valley, Palo Alto. You also worked in Germany, which has a much better work environment.
Yes.
I mean, even though Germany is very, I mean, they have a lot of problems with letting in all these migrants, there are aspects of social nationalism in their economic policies. But overall, would you say it just has a, I mean, I've visited there recently, and even with the migrant crisis, it still has a much higher standard of life than the United States. And you would just say it's a much better work environment, much better worker rights.
The German system is no doubt in my mind superior. So I've not only worked in those places you mentioned, I also worked in Australia. I've had some exposure to some Asian places as well. The German system, I might be getting this term wrong, it's like Ordo Economics, I think they call it, which is really a kind of a modified version, a version of National Socialism that, you know, I think Germans were a little shameful about what had happened during World War II, and kind of revised some of their ideas to be a little bit more flexible. And that was kind of what they came up with, this system that does allow some freedom, but mostly it still has that centralized character, at least when you compare it to America. And it is much more, it's superior for a lot of reasons. You know, like from my personal perspective, you know, the developers were better because they were more stable, right? They weren't constantly jumping around trying to gather skills for technologies that just came out like a week ago. You know, there was a lot of structure in place about what technologies are going to be used, for why they're going to be used, who's going to be the specialist, how do you get accredited, to be considered to be proficient in that technology. And all these things, no matter what you do, no matter what system you set up, all those things need to happen. Its question is, are you going to help them happen, or are you going to do things despite them happening, which is what describes what happens in America. In Germany, at least, they know, the government knows, or the planners know, that you need to have some level of stability. In fact, like most of the open source stuff, much of it, let's just say the movement was very strong in Germany. There was a SUSE. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of that software before. There was a brand of Linux that for many years was the best brand of Linux.
With the whole real estate situation within Israel, within California, one of the key issues is we have all these wealthy Chinese buying up real estate and jacking up the prices. Is there a similar problem in Israel with wealthy Americans buying up real estate in Israel?
Yeah, there's a couple of really interesting facts. I don't know the exact numbers. I remember somebody measured the amount of apartments in Jerusalem that were empty, and it was a large portion of them, just totally unoccupied. And meanwhile, I mean, you have native Israelis. They can barely afford an apartment. So if you think the Californian real estate situation is distorted and insane, go to Israel. It's far, far worse. So, again, it ties back into a lot of these outlawed views on economics, which are related to National Socialism, that, you have international capital. It's like it's a taboo to even mention international capital. Right, like these guys with their libertarian rhetoric will go on and on and on and on and on about market optimization and supply demand curves and what have you, but they'll never talk about the fact that people go in and they buy everything out and then jack up and gouge the prices of the people who have to live there. Not everybody has the option to move to China or move somewhere else, right? They're Americans and they live in America. What are you going to do if somebody owns all the property?
That's a huge problem, and especially, talking about tech in the Silicon Valley, there's this massive housing shortage because of the tech industry. Then on top of that, you have these multi-million dollar homes in places like Palo Alto that are bought up by these ultra-wealthy Chinese, and they're just sitting on them and leaving them empty.
Right, because all they do is they just let it appreciate and then sell it and make themselves loads of money while at the same time supposedly generating jobs. All these things that, they're like gaming each part of the system and basically making America completely unlivable while they are making very large amounts of money. The solution is very, very simple. I mean, you have to have some expert come in there, analyze what's going on, figure out, what should be the cost of housing and how do we make this more comfortable. There is an argument that says, if we regulate too much, it's not going to be a very livable place. And that is kind of true. You don't want to take ownership. You don't want to build projects in Palo Alto, right? I mean, I think that's the fear, that you're going to have this so-called odious government housing situation. Nobody likes that. In fact, there's a lot of correlation between home ownership and so-called nice neighborhoods. But on the other hand, really, the problem isn't that. The problem isn't like projects. The problem is people. This international capital is greatly distorting, what the prices are for these places. And
yeah, that's
as a result,
that's the issue. Is you have these wealthy NIMBYs who they restrict housing. I mean, most of them are boomers, and I can understand why people don't want like a large underclass component in their neighborhood. We're not really talking about the people from the ghetto who live in the projects. Even the millennial children of the upper class, or at least upper middle class, even those people can't afford real estate.
Right. Well, I mean, you kind of hit the nail on the head, Robert. It was fine when they were doing it to the ghetto people, right? But now the problem extends to their children. Which shows a bit of hypocrisy, and of course now it's considered to be more of a problem. But the boomers really don't seem to be budging in their view of how things are to be solved and what the problem is. So, I certainly foresee a bit of a social upheaval you know, the kids are just going to get tired of working these dismal jobs just to afford a roof over your head. What is this? This is the 21st century. We can't provide living spaces for people. They just don't want to. That's really what it comes down to. They don't want to. They want everybody in poverty. You know, so unless, you know, and until they somehow organize and get into politics and change the system, it's going to continue. In fact, in Australia, they had this problem years before we did. It was like, I think the 80s, you know, they had this problem of like out of control housing. And it was really the Brits, you know, the English that were going in there, and because they have more money than the Australians. I don't know if you've ever been there before, but, you know, there's quite a disparity between like what they call the Pommies. That's stands for Prisoner of Mother England, you know, so it's kind of like a funny derogatory term that Australians use to describe the English.
Oh, yeah, well, I've talked about this concept a lot, but Matthew, you even wrote an article about this, so if you look at dissident politics, the alt-right was primarily a movement of the more kind of traditional middle class suburban
working people. Let's use the word. Come on.
You
know, why are we scared of saying working class people? I mean, that's who they are, and that's what we're talking about. Yeah, a lot of them are white. You know,
that's true. Yeah, but I'm going beyond that. What Matthew's article is more about is this next generation who are like upper middle class Whipples, and like what's going to happen with them? I mean, Matthew, what was the point you were getting at, and how that kind of transcends beyond the alt-right?
Oh, just that I think that in the alt-right, or whatever the alt-right now becomes, there's potential for a more cross social class. I mean, there already is this. You have Richard Spencer's people who were the kind of more upper middle class, culturally elitist types, but they were also in coalition with the Traditionalist Workers' Party and working people. And I think in that article you're referencing, what I was kind of trying to get at is more so than anything else was the potential for coalition between the sort of Bernie Sanders, Occupy Wall Street crowd and the alt-right in all of its different factions. And wondering if that will be a vibrant social movement in decades to come, or perhaps just the whole political binary will shift and everyone will move in a more nationalistic direction. Because there are certainly elements of economic nationalism to Bernie Sanders' platform.
I guess to frame that as a question.
Yeah, I like many things about him.
I think he's going to the White House personally. He's got a huge following at this point, so, and it's just getting stronger. You know that he recently declared he's now running as an independent. He completely abandoned the Democratic Party, but please go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, just to frame it as a question, do you see any possible, strange alliances occurring over the next 10 years, or are the differences too deep between people with alt-right sympathies and people with Bernie Sanders sympathies? Can economic nationalists unite a surprising coalition?
Okay, well, I think that Bernie's kind of really got a pretty good package together. You know, I'm not really criticizing Bernie at all. I even put out a little note after Trump got elected that, you know, Bernie was important for a variety of reasons. He didn't make it. I think probably the primary reason was Hillary screwed him over. But he will be back, and he is. He's coming back. He may anoint somebody else, and that person may run. Either maybe he's a little bit too progressed in age, or perhaps he's not up for it. But he's going to do something to influence politics in a major way. Now, I think your question is: will there be anything strange or noteworthy about, you know, what's going to happen there? I saw the alt-right kind of like as a strange thing, you know. When you get this problem of socialism, right, what happens? Like, you're throwing everybody into the same economic class where, and this has happened before, this happened during the 60s, so there was a pretty strong socialist groundswell during the 60s, and suddenly white people were kind of in the same, hanging out with black people, where before that, they didn't even really talk much, which is probably what rock and roll was really about. It was kind of like a mixture between black music styles and white music styles. So
yeah, I definitely see that fusion happening in the future. And just looking at the economic situation, I think you mentioned this on one of your Facebook posts. So a lot of the middle-class jobs have been ruined through neoliberal economics, through privatization, massive immigration, outsourcing. So basically all the jobs left are a lot of these retail jobs and jobs in the service sector, which actually a lot of them cater to retirees.
Right. And, you know, you go on Facebook, you know, my favorite thing to do is actually read some of these conversations on Facebook. And you notice on there, like, you know, libertarianism, extreme, what really is extreme libertarianism? Like, some of these ideas have never been implemented in history and really have never even been taken seriously by any real economist, at least somebody with some kind of an academic record. And suddenly you go on Facebook and, like, that's the dominant idea, which shows you, I mean, Facebook is obviously has some sort of algorithm to emphasize those viewpoints. You know, everybody knows that libertarian guy on the Facebook who never seems to want to shut up because he believes that his ideas are far more like prolific than they really are in real life. You know, I'm sure you've run into people like this, you know, and they're on the internet and they think their ideas are very acceptable and very popular, but then they go into real life and they find out nobody even cares. There's a huge disparity there, which, and again, the point is obviously Facebook has an agenda to promote that viewpoint because it's owned by very, very wealthy people. You know, they want those viewpoints to be the standard. Whereas really the reality is somewhere very much centric between, you know, socialist and capitalism.
With restrictions on rent, Joshua, would you say that Germany has, they have a much stricter regulations on the rent-based economy?
Oh, yeah. Like the laws there are far more in favor of renters than what you see in America, even in the blue states, shockingly so. Like, for instance, I remember one of my friends described this to me. He said that in Germany, if your window is broken and the landlord doesn't fix it within like a day, then you basically get free rent for a month. I mean, can you imagine that in America? Which creates a different sort of scenario. Like, you don't have these small-time landlord people. Either your place is owned by a professional, you know, professional management company, or you own it yourself. Those are typically the two ways that Germans live. Which, you know, to me, it's good. You know, these, I don't know, I think Americans view this kind of individual landlording as somehow good. I personally don't. I just, these people don't really provide a very useful service to society. They tend to be parasitic. They tend to be annoying. You know, they don't do a very good job. So that's where I'd like to see America go. You know, we need better laws about how living standards work. Hmm. And what rights people have when they become a tenant. If you guys have ever lived in New York, you know, renters' rights probably have the longest, broadest history in New York State. And there are laws like that, you know, about who you can discriminate against. You know, you can't just say, oh, I don't like you, you can't rent from me. You know, you can get sued for doing something like that. And, you know, there are laws about how you can evict someone. You know, I've heard of situations where people are still staying in their house for months at a time without paying rent because the landlord is unable to evict them.
With the urban planning model, Israel is a much smaller geographically than the United States. So does Israel have the same model of a suburban sprawl as California in the Southwest? I mean, you lived in Arizona, or is it much more a compact development?
It's nothing like America at all. I mean, they don't, as far as I understand, they don't really have like parcel auctions. I could be mistaken on that one. But, you know, anyone who's been there knows that, you know, there isn't this kind of like free market of I want to build a house or a development in this spot and then I'm going to sell them. That does not really happen in Israel because there's a lot of other factors too. You know, they have to worry about if we build here, you know, is it going to be a terrorist, you know, is it going to be a military issue? You know, do we have to defend it? You know, those all equate to costs, right? So
we in California, we don't really have the terrorist threat, but we have massive wildfires, and they still have these real estate developers building tract housing developments in high-risk areas.
Right, and I don't really know how that works. I guess the insurances go sky high. I mean, where does all the money go, or who covers it when it burns? Or I don't know. I'm sure there's a lot of complexities to that. But you know, the answer to your question is, in Israel, no, it does not work in this free-form way at all.
Well, the thing is, conservatives have this mentality that you have to own a single-family home if you want to start a family. And this ties in with what we were saying earlier, how millennials, I mean, especially middle-class white millennials, are not able to start families. A lot of it is economics. A lot of it is real estate. I was reading somewhere that Israel actually has the highest birth rate in the developed world. Is that primarily because of the ultra-Orthodox, or is there something about their economic policies, or is it just the hyper-nationalism?
Well, I mean, first off, I would be wary of those numbers. I'm not sure how believable that they actually are, but certainly the most biologically prosperous people in Israel are the religious groups. Probably first is the Haredi. Those are like the real hardcore Orthodox, and then you have modern Orthodox who also tend to have a lot of kids as well. You know, now it's really interesting. Like a group of people that I had met when I went there were these modern Orthodox people, you know, who tend to greatly coincide with the settler movement, and they have a lot of kids, and then you see their kids growing up and they have a lot of different ideas about Israel because, you know, they didn't come from America. They didn't come from a land of prosperity. They grew up in Israel and they have limitations and they have much different viewpoints about how Israel should be governed. There seems to be a lot of disparity between that generation, like these boomer American Israelis, and their children. They tend to have much different ideas about politics.
Oh, so you're saying millennials in Israel would be more sympathetic to social nationalism than the boomers there?
Yes, to socialism in general, no doubt about it.
Bauhaus architecture is really notable for Tel Aviv. I think it is a UNESCO World Heritage Site titled the White City. And a lot of these architects, the Bauhaus architects, were German Jews who fled after World War II. And a lot of the original Bauhaus was in Germany. And that was basically the inspiration for mid-century modern. I found something really interesting online is in Tel Aviv. They're building this high-rise that's... It's a modern high-rise, but it's influenced by that Bauhaus aesthetic. And I'm sure these condos or apartments are going through for the ultra-wealthy, but it's a really remarkable building. And I'm just kind of fascinated with that theme of taking a style from the past and putting it towards something new, in the sense it basically is like archaeo-futurism.
Yeah, I saw the picture of it. You know, it's kind of like interesting architectural references, but yeah, you know, I would tend to think that this building is being built because those Bauhaus buildings are quite valuable. So, you know, they want to ride that. To your point in your question about Jews fleeing Germany, I'm not really sure if that was exactly what had occurred. You know, certainly the Bauhaus movement was associated with futurism, right, which was associated with Mussolini. So, you know, were these Bauhaus aficionados, were they, in fact, opposed? You know, exactly what was their identity? I'm not really completely sure we all understand what that is.
Can Bauhaus be the aesthetic of social nationalism?
It is the aesthetic. All of those, if you read the writings of Courbusier or, you know, the other people associated with, they were all fascists. You know, after the war, they kind of revised that and chalked it up a little bit, smudged this and that, but yeah, they were 100% behind fascist ideas. The problem was this, Robert. You know, like, they were creating a new world. Remember, I mean, they had just emerged from World War II, which dismantled all of the great military empires. So there was a lot of questions about how are we going to do this, right? You know, there wasn't any court architect anymore because there wasn't any court. So they had to come up with a new way, like, how are we going to do this? That's what Bauhaus was. You know, they wanted to create a new aesthetic, you know, that was simplified. It wasn't overly ornate. It was functional. I think it was Courvoisier who said that, right? Form over function. You know, so these guys were fascists, all right? The Bauhaus aesthetic is hand-in-hand with fascism. They go together. They're like best friends, BFFs.
Okay. I love Bauhaus.
So
is it related to brutalism, would you say? I'm trying to make a still work out of it. Yeah.
Brutalism was kind of like a revival. I think brutalism is really mostly UK-centric, but I could be wrong on that one.
That sounds right.
Yeah, it's in the UK, but I noticed brutalism in the Czech Republic, so it's in a lot of countries.
Yeah. The themes certainly are, you know, they have in common with Bauhaus, but I would recommend just reading some of those writers. You know, they kind of, when you do architecture, it's expensive, right? Building a building is not cheap. It's not something you can do in your garage. So if you want to do it, you have to justify that. That's why architecture is considered to be one of the greatest forms of art, because an architect doesn't just draw lines. He has to write, and he has to justify, and he has to use his mind to prove why we need to build a building this way, right? Like, why should we build it this way as opposed to this way? And obviously you have to convince the people, the investors, why to do it. So you go to those architects and those early Bauhaus architects, and they explain, you know, what their theory of why they want to build what they want to build. An interesting thing, did you go to Berlin when you were in Germany, Robert?
No, only Karlsruhe.
Because you go to Berlin, they still have some of that Nazi stuff is still there, and it stands out. I mean, the way that the lines and the way that the walls are built, you would never see that ever again. You know, and it's very dramatic, and it's meant to say a certain thing about what is taking place inside of that building, and it's very striking. So I was just wondering if you saw it.
Oh, yeah, I am familiar with that. I mean, this doesn't really have anything to do with fascism, but it's interesting. Is in Germany, there's all these really cool retro-futuristic radio and television towers, which look like they were built in the 60s and 70s. Did you notice that?
Yeah, well, Germans were really into radio. You know, like, you can look up the history of it. That was a big thing. After they emerged from World War II, that was the primary way that, you know, the German citizens were sort of coordinating a lot of these like, social movements. The hippie movement was really strong in Germany. You know, they wanted to abandon what happened during World War II. But I'll tell you another interesting anecdote. I lived in Hanover. I was actually working for like a fashion apparel company. I was doing their e-commerce stuff. And it was in a place called Garbsen. And both Hanover and Garbsen had a lot of stuff that Hitler had built, you know, like public works. And it was still impressive by today's standards, the stuff that Hitler did over almost 100 years ago.
Well, yeah, I did drive on the Autobahn, but I ended up getting car sick, and I already had a hangover.
Excellent. Yeah, a friend of mine took me in his Audi. He's like, want to see how fast this thing goes? I think we got up to about 140 or something like that. But, yeah, I don't know why Americans are so fascinated with the Autobahn, but, yeah.
Within Israel, I mean, there definitely is a higher status for people who are more European-looking, and if you look at a lot of the like model contestants, a lot of them are very like German or Slavic looking.
No doubt. And it's, you know, I mean, it's kind of like a shameful secret that Europeans are favored there. And they even use the word Aryan, the Hebrew word for somebody who looks, you know, like German, like Dolph Lundgren or something. You know, it's called, they call them Ari.
Would you describe yourself that way?
I think I look more like that than certainly most Jews. You know, I have some qualities that maybe look a little bit not European, but it's very, very faint. You know, not all my family was of Jewish background, so, you know, I'm technically a mixture. But when I went there, I'm very European looking. When I went there, certainly girls favor that over the so-called Semitic type, whatever that, you know, I'm not even sure. We could talk for hours about what that even means and how valid some of those stereotypes really are, and they're not very valid. You know, we like to think Jews look a certain way, but I don't really think that has all that much basis in reality.
Robert has this, I don't know if you've come across it on his podcast or other work, if you've read his novel, but he has this obsession with blonde Jewish woman, whether Joshua's come across it before.
I know he has an obsession with Jewish women. We've been over this before.
It's like demographic groups within Israel have the highest concentration of blondes.
They would be like lower middle class because those are the Russians.
Oh, really? I would think so. It would be sort of the German descended elite in like North Tel Aviv.
No, like so that pocket, like the super wealthy Ashkenazi liberals, I don't really think are very blonde. They seem to be, to me, they're highly like, they're very swarthy. They're very Jewishy looking sort of people.
That's interesting because I would associate like blonde hair with kind of high status and the elite.
No, so there was a pocket of Russians that came to Israel around. They started coming in after the USSR was starting to deteriorate. You know, that was kind of like an economic escape hatch for them. And a lot of these people, I'm not the only one who suspects this, were not actually even Jewish in the least. They just sort of fabricated that as a way to get a passport, you know, to Israel. There's an interesting, a fascinating relationship kind of growing between Russia and Israel, which could fill books at this point. Again, that a lot of Americans aren't really all that aware of. It's very strong. You know, Putin had come out and, you know, really just applauding and you know, like stroking Israel the last couple of years. You know, in ways that were really, to me, it was sort of striking that, you know, he's that gushingly pro-Israel.
I wonder if that was during the Obama era when there was some tension.
It could be. It's also that Israel is one of the few Russian-speaking countries out there. It's Russia. I'm not sure if Russian's been declared an official language, but it might as well be. I mean, there's entire towns where Russian is the spoken language there.
Is your ancestry more from Germany or Russia and Eastern Europe?
I had a family member take one of those DNA tests, and I did. My father is 100%. You know, he showed up on 23andMe as being practically 100% Ashkenazi, which was a little surprising. You know, because you know, he looks. My father's like very. He's like blue eyed. Very white, you know. The other side has a whole bunch of different things. And one grandmother who claims to have, you know, incredibly has like some colonial ancestors, like colonial Dutch. And her husband, my grandfather, came from Poland. So there's a lot of stuff in there, you know. I mean, but to even be like half genetically Ashkenazi, that's actually a lot for Israel. Most Jews do not have that genetic profile in abundance. It's relatively rare. Let me say a couple more points here, and I want to point this out because I spent a lot of time with this guy, and I just want to send a little shout out to all your readers. There's a scholar named Shlomo Sand. I don't know if you guys have heard of this person. And he wrote a book called The Invention of the Jewish People. And I highly recommend that everybody read this book. If you're an Israeli or you're an American Jew or you have some kind of Jewish root somewhere, or you're just interested in the topic, he's really just laying out the science of this very suppressed region of research. You know, it's very controversial. And the guy has been slammed over and over again. Undeservedly, you know, for his findings about, you know, where Jews actually came from. And, you know, surprise, they didn't come from the Middle East. At least Ashkenazis didn't. The Ashkenazis are really a European race. So, you know, we don't need to go into details here. Maybe do it another time if you want. But he's a great writer, and I highly recommend it to anyone.
That sounds really interesting, yeah. About the whole, and maybe it would be worth doing another show about, you know, European identity and Jewish identity.
Oh, yeah. If you want to talk about Shlomo San, him alone, he'll definitely get you clicks, no doubt. He's very, very hot right now. A lot of people are talking about it because, well, it dovetails in with this thing of the nationality law, right? So these people are saying, no, no, like they're basically saying Jews only. But who are they? You know, they're a European race that adopted Judaism in the Middle Ages. And then a whole number
so
of other things
happened. They should just explicitly say, we're European nationalists. We're a form of European nationalism.
Yeah, that irony is definitely there, Robert. You know, and believe me, you're not the first guy to put those two things together. Like, these people are essentially more about what Hitler said than anything else.
Yeah, Constantine von Hoffmeister, I'm sure, would argue similarly. Yeah, I was just interested when we were talking earlier about the difference between millennials and boomers, not just in the U.S., but all over the world, or at least in the U.S. and Europe and even in Israel, you were saying. So it's interesting to me, and one thing that I've been very interested over the past year or so as my politics have really started to evolve more is how both socialism and nationalism seem like they're really on the global upswing among millennials especially. And I don't necessarily see those two things as having come together yet. Really what I'm doing here is just rewording what I was saying earlier, but framing it differently. I don't necessarily see socialism and nationalism as having come together yet, but I see both things as very much on the rise among millennials in response to very real social needs, whether it's economic disenfranchisement or kind of socio-cultural disenfranchisement. Both of these things have kind of come at the expense of free market capitalism. So, yeah, it's not really a question. I just wanted to reword what I said earlier. I have what I would call a great hope that in the coming years, coming decades, that these two, at this point, disparate social groundswells will find common ground and will, you know, that social nationalism will become a much more mainstream position.
Well, what's socialism without nationalism?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I was a socialist throughout college in many ways. I mean, I bounced back and forth a little bit. But what always struck me is there was an emptiness to the kind of pure, like, dogmatic Marxist-type socialism where it felt like it lacked any real culture or aesthetics. And I see social nationalism as the kind of harmony of rational social organization with aesthetics rooted in tradition and futurism, potentially.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Joshua Zeidner for being on. It's been an excellent show. I think to sum it up, it's basically what we want is social nationalism with futurist Bauhaus aesthetics and bonds, bonds, bonds.
Sounds good, Robert. Really great to be on here. Maybe we'll do some more shows in the future, and thanks a lot for having me on.
And thank you, Matthew.
Sure thing.